Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm very honored to be speaking with Professor Gregor Gal, who has written a wonderful book about Mick Lynch. The book was published by Manchester University Press this month. And we're really glad to have Professor Gregor Gal with us. Professor Gregor Gal is a visiting professor of industrial relations at the University of Leeds. The book is called Mick Lynch, The Making of a Working Class Hero, published by Manchester University Press. Gregor, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
Before we start talking about the book, can you please briefly introduce yourself, talk about your field of expertise, and more importantly, tell us why you decided to write a book about Mick Lynch?
I've been an industrial relations academic for over 30 years now. And in that time, the level of strikes has never been as high in Britain as it has been over the last couple of years. So this was an opportune time to look at the issues through the prism of Mick Lynch. In the late June of 2022, Mick Lynch went from being virtually unknown to the wider public to being extremely well known, if not, as I say in the book, called by many to be a working class hero. And that that transition was almost overnight. It took place as a result of three interviews on big television channels in Britain. One was with Piers Morgan, who many people might well know. Another was on GMTV, Good Morning Television, with Richard Madeley. And a third was on Sky News with an interviewer called Kay Burley. And in those interviews, he responded in such a robust and articulate and clever way that he put down those interviewers who had tried to put him down as a sort of upstart and somebody who, you know, really shouldn't be doing what he was doing in terms of leading a strike or defending the strike on the sort of national airwaves. So it's not often in your career, say, you know, it's been 30 years since I began, that such an opportunity arises to examine what's going on, not obviously right as it's going on, because by the time you do the research and write the book and it comes out, it always is going to be a bit of a delay. But to try and catch the zeitgeist of this new development in terms of, you know, the cost of living crisis, workers and unions for the first time in a generation really starting to stand up and fight back. So that was an opportunity. The motivation is that, as I say, I'm an industrial relations academic professor for many years. And if you are on the political left, as I am, and you're also an academic, you also want the opportunity to try to speak to people outside the academy, to be, if you like, a public intellectual, and let others know in a kind of less academic manner, if you like, in terms of the writing, about how analysis of power, of the state, of capital, of capitalism can be interesting and worthwhile for them to read.
Yeah, and I have several questions on that, which I'll ask you as we go through the interview. The good thing about your book is that first you come up with a theoretical framework, a definition. As you mentioned, he's become known as a working class hero. So you come up with a framework, a definition of working class hero. Can you please tell us what is the approach that you take to talk about working class hero? Who is a working class hero in the scope of your research?
Well, let me say, first of all, that it wasn't me, if you like, that came up with the term Mick Lynch being a working class hero. It was something that emerged organically by the very people who were watching those interviews and who were amazed and taken aback by how good he was. So what I picked up on was this perception that Mick Lynch is a working class hero. Now, in Britain, at any rate, and I'm sure this is true elsewhere, because of the decline of the radical left, of social democracy, of the unions, it's quite unusual for, if you like, ordinary people to remember a term such as working class hero and then also start applying it to somebody who they'd seen on television. So the reason why the book's called The Making of a Working Class Hero is to try to understand the process by which people use this term, and they did so in their thousands, if not millions. Certainly, what I was able to document was many, many people using it, and I think would be right in assuming that many more did use it. It's just that they didn't do so publicly on Twitter or, various other social media platforms. So it's about the process by which a perception was developed, and it was given a nomenclature, a name, a term. And if we go back in sort of time, recent time, if people are aware of the term working class hero, they might be aware of the song by John Lennon, which comes from the early 1970s. Then they might also be, again in Britain in particular, they might be aware that it was given to a small number of union leaders, and probably the best known one, back again in the time of the early 1970s, was Arthur Scargill, who was not at that point the General Secretary, the leader of the National Union of Mine Workers. He subsequently became that. He led in between 84 and 85 the biggest strike in Britain since the general strike in 1926, and that was over the pit closure programme. So by people using that term, they were opening up the issues to see, was Mick Lynch, were they right in calling him a working class hero? How did that process come about, and what would the outcomes be? And I suppose when I started looking at the literature on working class hero, I was quite amazed to find that it was never defined in all the source material that I could get hold of. It was just somehow taken as being self-evident of what a working class hero was. As I say, I found that rather unusual, to say the least. So I saw it as part of my job to lay out and elaborate a definition of a working class hero. And what I came up with, most obviously, this isn't rocket science, but the starting point must be that it is a person who represents the interests of the working class. Now, that's the kind of headline, if you like. When you start to dig underneath that, it obviously becomes a lot more complex. What is it meant to represent something? Is it just to articulate something, as in to say workers shouldn't, pay the cost of the crisis of the cost of living changes that are going on? They shouldn't pay for the crisis of capitalism. Is it just words, if you like? Or is there more to it than that? Are there actions that lie behind those words that would be compatible with those words? So the prosecution of certain mass collective struggles. And then there's the other issue is, does a working class hero have to be of the working class? Does that mean they have to have come originally from the working class? Does it mean they still have to be in the working class, as in a member of that social class? Or can they be somebody else who is recognised by working class people primarily to be one of their heroes? And so we come across examples of footballers, pop stars, other sportsmen and women who might have been called a working class hero, largely because in those terms they were seen to be still willing to use their profile to say certain progressive, politically progressive things, even though they had long since left the working class in an objective sense. They had long since left that social class in terms of their material wealth, their ability to protect themselves from the ravages of the free market, and so on. And in the case of Mick Lynch, it's clear to me that while he is emotionally and psychologically still very much connected to the working class, as you would expect in terms of what his aspirations are, culturally, the kind of things he likes as well, in objective terms, he is no longer a member of the working class, not just because he has a very large salary, which would be the salary of a senior manager if you think about other organizations, but also because he leads and is effectively like the chief executive of an organization which has 80,000 members, has a turnover through, membership dues being paid in the millions, has a property portfolio in the millions, and also has stocks and shares worth over 25 million £1,000. Now, I don't say any of that to denigrate Mick Lynch. The book is a celebration of Mick Lynch, but also a critique of him and what he's done and what he says and how he's gone about things. But on that point of me saying he is no longer objectively a member of the working class, as I say, that is in no way an attempt to denigrate him. It is merely as a social scientist looking at that situation. Now, for many people, that will be a contentious point. But I do think it then shows a rather superficial understanding of what it means to be working class or any kind of class analysis. And you don't have to be a Marxist to have a class analysis. You could be a follower of Weber. Nonetheless, you would have set criteria which you would have to enforce in, or imply, if you like, in assessing where somebody's class location was. So just to recap, I suppose, I looked at the issues of process. How does somebody become to be called a working class hero? And what are the outcomes? And I'll discuss the outcomes more with you in a moment. But the one final thing to say about the status of a hero is almost exclusively about somebody who is seen to be able to do things on behalf of others that they cannot do themselves. Now, in terms of working class consciousness and the union movement, that's an interesting phenomenon, because most people on the left would say we shouldn't have heroes. Yes, we have leaders, but they must be accountable. We all must be leaders, this kind of often platitudes. And so for people in Britain to have identified Mick Lynch as a working class hero says that on the one hand, they're more open to the ideas that he's espousing, which are really ideas of social democracy rather than socialism, but also that they, at this point in time, even if they were to go on strike, do not feel they are able to prosecute their interests in a way that they might wish to, that is to say, to do so in a through mass struggle, which is successful. And therefore, they look to somebody like Mick Lynch to do things that they cannot do, because he has access to the national media. He has the ability to lead a powerful union. And also, he has, if you like, the gift of the gab. He's an articulate operator, and many of them may not be able to do that.
Again, you have raised a lot of important points. We do talk about some of the criticism that maybe you have of Mick Lynch. But when I read the book, as a matter of fact, I expected to read a book which is all, you know, applauding Mick Lynch. So I do see that in the book, but you also have some fair criticism of him as well, which I guess provides a perfectly balanced view towards him and his legacy. I'm also interested to know more about that process of becoming a working class hero that you talked about. So you talk about this, you have this schemata, persona, politics, period, and potential power. I would appreciate if you could talk about the schemata you use, and also later on go on to talk about some, because the time was perfect for him to become a working class hero, to become known as a working class hero, because of the socioeconomic conditions that in England, the cost of living, dissatisfaction with Tories, and also his performance in the media, which you just mentioned. Would be great if we could talk about these two things, the schemata and also that socioeconomic condition in England that gave him that, yeah, that paved the way for his becoming a hero.
So when I first used the evidence of other people identifying Mick Lynch as a working class hero, I also asked the counterfactual question, why was it not others? Why just Mick Lynch and why nobody else? And I used that as a way to try and open up what is it that's specific about Mick Lynch in terms of him as an individual, him as a union leader, him and his particular union, him and the political economic context in which he finds himself. And that's why I use these four words beginning with P, persona, politics, power, and period. So let me just look at the first one, the persona. Now, Mick Lynch is actually a fairly sort of shy person. So what people see and hear of Mick Lynch is kind of certain extrapolation of a particular bit of his personality. So it's not all of Mick Lynch, it's a particular aspect. And that's, that's quite a common phenomenon that people will, if you like, exaggerate or develop certain parts of their personality to develop a persona, which they believe will be effective in whatever, public life or public job they're doing. So Mick Lynch, in terms of how we've seen him on the television, on the radio, on the picket line, all these kind of things, he's very strong, he's very forthright, he's very frank, he's often sardonic, he's often sarcastic. And he is the kind of person who will always respond in very robust terms to anything that, that is put to him. The one thing that he does, which many others don't have, is an ability. If he gets angry, he doesn't show it, and he certainly never stormed off from an interview, which I think would, you know, be a gift to his political opponents. So when he speaks, he's always very calm, he's always very measured. And I think that's really important, because it's showing that it's a bit like a kind of like the sucker punch. He takes it in, takes a step back, but isn't affected by it. And that's clearly what some of his the people that were interviewing him wanted to do. And they must have been very, very annoyed and aggrieved that he didn't react in that way. And they kept provoking him and provoking him and provoking him, particularly on the interview from Piers Morgan, which, just to remind people, as Mick Lynch himself said, it was a bizarre line of questioning, because it started off by saying, was Mick Lynch the Hood, a character from Thunderbirds? And if Mick Lynch was the Hood, and this is because there was an avatar of the Hood on Mick Lynch's Facebook, then if he was trying to be the Hood, then the Hood was a mastermind, you know, world criminal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, at that point, many people might have just sworn or walked off set, but Mick Lynch kept his cool, kept his calm, and not only did he answer, but he turned it back on Piers Morgan. So that's something of his persona. Now, when he's operating within the union, outside of the public gaze, from what I was able to detect from conducting interviews, there's a slightly different side emerges to him. That is one where he is quite domineering, if not also quite authoritarian at times. But, you know, most of us can only see the public side. Now, in terms of the politics, again, Mick Lynch has quite a, if you like, an idiosyncratic view of the world. I don't mean it's weird and put that in negative terms, but he is social democrat and not a socialist. And what I mean by that is that his political ambition is to see a form of capitalism where there's a considerable regulation of the relationship between labour, workers, and capital, employers, and capitalism itself. Now, just to put it in very simple terms, a socialist is somebody who wishes to see the abolition of capitalism. Mick Lynch doesn't want to see that. In fact, in some of his interviews, he made it clear that in terms of where his sympathies lie, or lay for the October Russian Revolution, it was with Julius Martov and not with Lenin and Trotsky. So that was, you know, part and parcel of what his worldview is, what his perspective is. And he's somebody who is well-read. He went to the London School of Economics in the late 1980s. So this is not something that he has just, you know, got some superficial understanding of. He has an understanding of history. He's chosen to draw certain conclusions from it. Those are, whether one likes them or not, they are robust and they are worked out. So, you know, that he has to be given credit for that. So his politics are there. And I can talk about what that means in terms of his views of the Keir Starmer-led Labour Party at the moment. But he's a social democrat, not a socialist. It makes him radical because in Britain, as in elsewhere, neoliberalism has dominated the political agenda for the last 40-odd years. So he sticks out. He is not somebody who is going to advocate a kind of partnership with employers. He's not somebody who's a moderate. He's more, if you like, a militant. Excuse me. But there are limits to that. Excuse me. Well, I'll just take the tea. Now, in terms of the period, I've just mentioned the term neoliberalism, which is shorthand, as most of us would use it, for the rolling back of the state, the opening up of markets where they maybe didn't previously exist, privatisation, contracting out, all that kind of thing. So the period that we're in is one where, despite the great financial crisis of the early or the late 2000, you know, the beginning of the new millennium, 2008, 2009, despite that, despite the pandemic, which showed governments that were neoliberal using massive state intervention and expenditure to stabilize the capitalist economies. Despite all that, neoliberalism, to my mind, is still the dominant ideology that runs most of the world, and is still, unfortunately, in my mind, pretty much as strong as it ever was, even if particular parties suffer electoral defeats, as the Conservative Party in Britain looks like it will. If that is the case in Britain, the Conservative government is going to be replaced by a Labour government, which, led by Keir Starmer, is a kind of iteration of Tony Blair and New Labour. So not a return to old Labour, not a return to social democracy. So those are the conditions that that Mick Lynch's and the RNT, the union he leads, are operating in. Part of the detail of that is that unions are essentially only half as strong as they used to be in union membership compared to 1979. The level of strikes prior to 2022 hit its lowest level since records began. Some of those records began in the 1890s. So, you know, well over 100 years, it's the lowest level strike action. So that's all part of the context. And I think if one casts our minds back to the time when Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party, you could see that although on the one hand, the neoliberal agenda was still dominant, if not still in the ascendancy, there was at the same time a kind of undercurrent of palpable dissatisfaction, mass dissatisfaction, with it and its outcomes in terms of rising social inequality and so on. And that's why Corbyn was so popular. People hoped that he would be able to turn back the tide of neoliberalism. That obviously wasn't the case. He was essentially done in by not only the Tories and the media, but done in by the right wing in his own party. So that's all about the period that I try to deal with and how Mick Lynch fits into that. Does Mick Lynch begin to change that situation? And the last aspect, the other P, is the potential power of his members. Most people would probably think that rail workers in Britain and probably in other countries around the world have a lot of power. They certainly have the power to disrupt. And what I mean by that is the power to go on strike. Pretty much the whole rail network comes to a halt. There are few alternatives to using rail that have such a, you know, an immediate bearing on things. So, for example, if the railway network is shut down, cars, buses, planes are unable to take up the slack very easily. So that does mean the power to disrupt is quite in evidence. But looking back at the history of strikes on the railways in Britain, at any rate, I can't speak about other countries, but in Britain, that power to disrupt did not necessarily bring about power over being power over the bargaining opponent, the employer or the government. And so that's why I call it potential power rather than, if you like, actual power. And I think that analysis of the difference between power to disrupt and power over has very much been borne out by, or that framework that I deployed has been very much borne out by the settlements, the two settlements and the two national rail strikes that went on for 18 months to 2 years. One was with Network Rail, which is the state-owned infrastructure company. It runs the tracks, you know, manages the stations, all that kind of thing. And the other dispute was with the train operating companies. Those are private sector companies who have the franchise to run, say, rail services in the southeast of England or in the north of England. And they are often owned by many bigger companies, if you like, companies which are located, their ownership is located outside of Britain. In some cases, ironically, state-owned by the German rail company and by the Dutch rail company. So the settlements there were below inflation, considerably below inflation. And in order to even to get that, the strikes that went on for sometimes like 3 weeks, not 3 weeks solid, but, you know, a day here, a day there, or 2 days here that make up in total 3 weeks. And that represents 3 weeks lost wages. There was no strike pay. So you have a below inflation settlement and you have to pay to get it. And that's not something that I think is a great outcome. But as I say, the issues are explored in more detail in the book. So that's the schemata, as you call it, the four, the person or the persona, the politics of that person, period in which they're operating, the political period in which they're operating, and the potential power of their members. The other question you asked about was essentially, how did Mick Lynch end up being the General Secretary of the RMT Union at the time that the strikes began? I use in the book terms like baptism of fire several times. I mean, technically, you can only have one baptism, but in my book, it suited the analysis to have three of them. And also, I use the term accidents of history. So, if you start with, those baptisms and accidents of history, Mick Lynch is blacklisted out of the construction industry, the industry that he was working in as a young man. He therefore is unable to get employment because employers have this blacklist, and when he applies for a job or is offered a job, they check him against this list. And the organization, the Consulting Association, as it was called, would say, no, don't employ him, so he doesn't get a job. So he has problems providing an income for his family. His wife does work, she's a nurse, but there's only one income coming into the family, and they have three children. So he's forced by blacklisting to go and get a job elsewhere where there is no blacklist as such. And that is Eurostar, the company that runs the trains underneath the English Channel between Britain and France. He, having been a union activist, that's why he was blacklisted originally. He starts to become active in the RMT, the union that organises amongst most of the staff in Eurostar. So that's the first, if you like, both a baptism of fire, the blacklisting, but also this accident of history that he's forced out of one industry into another by the actions of the employers. And then, as I say, he starts to become active and organises the workforce at Eurostar. The next, if you like, accident of history is that Bob Crowe, who was the General Secretary prior to Mick Lynch was a man called Mick Cash. Prior to him, it was Bob Crowe, who was seen as probably the best General Secretary the RMT has ever had. Bob Crowe died at a very early age. He died on the 11th of March 2014. If Bob Crowe hadn't had died, he was in his early 50s. If he hadn't had died, he could well have gone on and been the General Secretary for another 10 years. And that would have, in terms of a kind of like succession, if you like, that would have meant it was unlikely that Mick Lynch would have ever ended up being General Secretary. The other accident of history is that Mick Cash, the successor to Bob Crowe and the predecessor of Mick Lynch, he retires or resigns. There's a different views about it, but essentially there's an internal faction fight within the union. Mick Cash doesn't get his way and leaves. And again, if that hadn't happened, the space, this opportunity for Mick Lynch to become General Secretary wouldn't have opened up. There are elections for all these posts. It's not as though Mick Lynch is appointed. He stands and fights for that post and wins. And then you come to the kind of another baptism of fire, another accident of history. There's a cost of living crisis starts to develop in the early part of 2022. It starts to develop and comes to fruition. And therefore, it's Mick Lynch, who is the General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, the RMT, at the point that the cost of living crisis happens. And in addition to that general feature of the economy in Britain, within the rail industry itself, there's also been a long-standing plan to reduce the numbers of people working in the industry, increase their productivity, introduce flexible work practices, and so on. Excuse me. And therefore, a general feature, the cost of living crisis, and a specific feature, this modernisation programme in the rail industry, come together. Mick Lynch is the General Secretary. The time when it comes to a head, he's the one that leads the opposition, is compelled to lead the opposition because of his members. So there are a number of features that you have to see kind of come into play or put in train in order to understand why certain individual leads a certain union at a certain point in time with a certain outcome.
The next question I have is about his background. You did talk a little bit about his background, but I'm keen to know more about where that passion for justice and, you know, his involvement with unions came from, when and why he joined RMT, and even during his employment with RMT, there was this quick ascension, let's say, and rise to the top managerial orders of the organization. And you do call him a mover and a shaker in that organization. So I'm keen to know more about his background as well.
I think the first thing to say about Mick Lynch is he comes from an immigrant Irish background. His parents, his mother moved from Armagh, which is in the north of Ireland, and his father moved from Cork, which is in the south of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland. They both moved to Britain during the Second World War because it was actually easier to get employment in London than it was back in their respective places where they lived in the north and south of Ireland. So it's not uncommon for people of an Irish background in Britain, of Irish descent, to have great psychological and cultural links with their ancestry and their heritage. And that's certainly the case with Mick Lynch. He doesn't hold a British passport. He holds an Irish passport. He is very much enamoured with all things Irish in terms of sport in particular. And one of his, if not the political hero that he has, is a person called James Connolly, who, although born in Edinburgh, also was of Irish descent and ended up being one of the leaders of the Easter Uprising in 1916, which was the beginning of the events that led to the Irish War of Independence, where Britain lost most of its first colony. And also there was that then led on to the Irish Civil War between those who wanted to accept or reject the terms of peace from Britain. James Connolly was shot and injured in that uprising, and then he was so badly injured that he was executed sitting on a chair. James Connolly wasn't just one of the leaders of that uprising. Prior to that, he had been a union organizer both in Ireland and in America. He was a revolutionary socialist, and that's interesting because the revolutionary socialism part of James Connolly doesn't really fit very easily in with Mick Lynch's politics itself. But nonetheless, it's just an indication of the orientation of Mick Lynch towards his Irish ancestry, and obviously a particular part of it. He doesn't wouldn't be in favour of all things Irish. There are clearly many reactionary parts of the kind of Irish tradition. So he comes from that background. His parents were Labour supporters. His father was a shop steward, and politics were discussed in the household over the dinner table. As he develops and starts going out to pubs and drinking, you know, much of the conversation, the arguments in the pubs are also about politics. So he has a background in having a kind of informal, if you like, political education. He leaves school at 16, he doesn't go to university at that stage or college. He does, as I say, go to university later on when he's blacklisted and has the time and the opportunity to do so. And within the household, politics are discussed in terms of domestic politics, but also international politics, because around that time, there were many, important events in world history, whether it be the Watergate, you know, tapes and the break into the Democrats' headquarters, the civil rights movement in America, the general strike in France, in Paris in May 1968, demonstrations against the Vietnam War in Grosvenor Square in London, all these kind of things. So Mick Lynch is aware of all this growing up. He's also aware of the situation of the so-called Troubles, a guerrilla war that was happening in the north of Ireland. So all of that kind of thing is discussed, not just because he's Irish and he's got Irish parents, but it's helped by that. And he, and more so than his siblings, they develop you know, a political inclination, a political activity. So when Mick Lynch gets his first job, he joins a union. He's not particularly active at that stage. He's, you know, he's only 16 or 17. But later on, he becomes more active. And the union that he was in initially was an electrician's union, because that was the actual job that he was training to be an apprentice electrician or electrician engineer. And that union is expelled from the main union federation in Britain, the Trade Union Congress, because of its practices. And Mick Lynch becomes part of a small group of people who set up a new union, a breakaway union that tries to get back into the Trade Union Congress. So he's, you know, not only is he active, but he's had to do a lot of work to set up a, help set up a new union from scratch. And he's very active. He's essentially one of the key people in London for doing that. And then, as I mentioned earlier, he, when blacklisted, he moves to the Eurostar company, finds that the workforce there is not organised. That's the workforce that are not the train drivers. The train drivers are organised, but everybody else is not organised. And he takes the lead in building a branch that ends up having a union branch that ends up having about 500 members. So he is active in those things. He's not just active, he leads in many cases. So he's developing leadership skills. He starts going to RMT annual conference, which again is something which is quite a sort of something that stands out, because it's a very small conference, only of about 60 people. And so you have to be a leading activist to be able to be elected to go there. He then stands to be elected to the National Executive, which he does. And he, after the second attempt, he wins. He also stands, but doesn't isn't successful in trying to become the president of the union, which is a lay position. And then, as I mentioned earlier on, he then ends up becoming the RM. Well, he first of all becomes the deputy, effectively the deputy general secretary, and then he becomes the general secretary. Both of those are elected posts. And I explained earlier how there are certain accidents of history that allow the opportunity to become those leaders to arise. Now, of course, just because there's the opportunity to become the general secretary, or prior to that, the deputy general secretary, doesn't mean that Mick Lynch would have won those posts. That's again goes back to why it is that he has a certain skills and, if you like, star quality. And all along the way, although not nearly so evident as in the last couple of years, you do get certain insights into his worldview, his political worldview, which is much more than just about unions and union politics. He makes certain pronouncements about the Labour Party. Even though he ceased to be a member of the Labour Party many years ago, he's still very supportive of it, critical of the current leadership. He was a Corbyn supporter, but also has quite a large amount of disdain for the far revolutionary or radical left, saying that essentially when they stand in elections, it's a waste of time. There really is only one show in town, and that's the Labour Party. For the left, at any rate, for the Labour Party, they like it or not. So that's the background to his politics. One of the things that makes Mick Lynch stand out is that he supported Brexit, that is Britain leaving the European Union. And that might sound relatively strange, but there was a left-wing campaign to leave the European Union called Lexit, that is left exit, when Brexit itself stood for Britain exit or exiting. And it led to a lot of controversy, because even though there were good reasons for the left to campaign and argue for the leaving of the European Union, because it had become dominated by a neoliberal ideology, it was still clear to most people that it was the right wing, the likes of Nigel Farage and UKIP, the UK Independence Party, that were making the running on leaving the European Union. And therefore, I think, and I think this is a fairly uncontroversial point, it was almost impossible to see how there could have been a left-wing exit from the European Union, given that those that initiated the campaign, that dominated the campaign, not just Nigel Farage, but also Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, were from the right wing, not just the kind of moderate right, but the radical right, and they dominated it. And that's why they were able to tap in to the discontent that did exist. So that there's a controversy, or certainly was at the time, and it will continue for some people, that you have somebody like Mick Lynch who supported Brexit. In fact, one left-wing comedian called, in a column he wrote about Mick Lynch, said that he was a Brexit arse made good. He was an arse for supporting Brexit, but then he was made good by what he did over the cost of living crisis and so on. That comedian was Stuart Lee. So Mick Lynch's politics are certainly very interesting. As I say, I've characterised them as a social democrat rather than a socialist. He has certain things that are might be seen to be idiosyncratic. The likes of saying James Connolly is a hero and supporting Brexit. And the last thing I'll touch on in terms of politics is his attitude towards the Labour Party. Although he is no longer a member of the Labour Party, he clearly supports the Labour Party as the only credible alternative to the current Conservative Party and government. So that's, you know, that's nothing unusual there. Most union leaders do that. Many unions are affiliated to the Labour Party. The RMT isn't. It used to be, but it left when it supported the Scottish Socialist Party. So I say that's not unusual. But what is unusual about Mick Lynch and some other union leaders is that they are supportive, but critically supportive of the Labour Party, and particularly the current leader, Sir Keir Starmer. And what essentially they're doing is saying, we want Labour to win, but we want Labour to win on a more left-wing, a more progressive platform or set of policies than is being offered at the moment. Again, nothing unusual in that. But the rub is that they're doing that without a cat in hell's chance of it coming to pass. And they say the reason for that is that since the end of 2022, the Labour Party, led by Keir Starmer, has been well ahead in the polls, always in excess of double digits, sometimes as high as 25% ahead in the polls. Now, polls are obviously a snapshot at one particular point in time. What does somebody or 1,000 people say about which party they would vote for if an election happened on that day? They were asked about it. So it's not, you know, absolutely certain that Labour will win by that majority. But every poll has shown that, and so it's hard to believe that it won't happen. So the problem for Mick Lynch and others is that they want Keir Starmer to be more left-wing, but what Keir Starmer is doing by going to the right, having basically junked all the policies that Jeremy Corbyn established, that strategy by Keir Starmer is proving successful. And there's no reason why he would jeopardise that poll lead by developing or adopting different policies. And that's something that none of the union leaders, Mick Lynch most obviously, have been able to get their heads around. They keep on asking for and pleading with Keir Starmer to do more, to be more left-wing, but it's falling on deaf ears. And some of them, including Mick Lynch, also go as far as to say that Keir Starmer needs to reveal his real self. Well, Keir Starmer has revealed his real self. He is a new Labour Blairite, leader of the Labour Party. He's not an old Labour social democrat. And so again, you know, there's an element of political naivety there. The one, if you like, caveat I would add to that is that while you can characterise that as being rather naive, making that political demand or plea, it has to be held in the context that there are now no credible left-wing alternatives to the Labour Party. It's not as though you can say, well, It doesn't matter what Labour does. We've got another, something that we can support. Or if Labour doesn't do this, then it will lose support to a left-wing party. There are many, many left-wing parties in Britain, as there are in Australia, America, or anywhere else. But very, very few of them have any substantial popular public support. So you can understand how something that seems naive is still nonetheless the most, if you like, realistic thing to say, or the realistic option to follow, even if, in your heart of hearts, you know that it won't fly.
On the point, I did want to ask you about his views about the current Labour government, not the government, sorry, the Labour Party. And you talked about it, and unfortunately, it's kind of, I guess, a universal problem that the Labour has more and more shifted towards right-wing policies, and the only thing they can probably celebrate is, for example, there is the identity politics side of things rather than the economic side of things, which is probably what a lot of more people, the working class people, want. It's in your book, you also talk about his leadership style, and that's where you're a little bit critical of him. Your argument is that his leadership style is a little bit autocratic or authoritarian. Can you talk about this aspect of Mick Lynch?
Yeah, but before I do that, I mean, in terms of his leadership, one of the, if not the key point that I make in the book is that while Mick Lynch has many leadership attributes, his ability to enthuse and motivate, his ability to articulate a coherent ideology of social democracy, his blind spot or weak point, as I argue in the book, is his lack of strategic planning. And the reason that I make a fist of this point is because the RMT knew well that this battle was happening, not in terms of the cost of living crisis, that obviously was something that was added to the mix, but it knew that both the Conservative and Labour parties, when in government, wanted to modernise the railway industry. They wanted to do so by reducing the headcount, changing working practice, all that kind of thing. And so, and the RMT had said it was going to oppose that. And for various reasons, that battle kept on being deferred. But then with the Conservative government, it decided to actually start implementing the changes that it was said that were needed. So that battle, if you like to use a metaphor, was a train that had been coming down the track for a long, long time. And that was one part of the equation. The other part of the equation was that in previous strikes, the RMT members had taken long periods of strike activity. They'd never been any more than one or 2 days together. So you might have had one day strike in 1 month, the next month you'd have another one day strike. And the reason that they were taking that kind of form of strike action was that without strike pay, RMT members didn't want to strike more than that because they didn't want to sustain the loss to their income. So you put together the fact that the modernisation was going to be implemented. And although RMT members were willing to strike, they were only willing to do so in a limited way. My argument is that the way to square that circle is for the RMT to have developed a national strike fund so that essentially it could not pay its members to be on strike because it wouldn't have enough money to do that, but it could certainly give them strike pay that would ameliorate much of the losses from going on strike. And the second largest union in Britain, the Unite Union, has done something very, very similar. It set up a strike fund over a decade ago. It wasn't particularly much used up until 2022, but has since been used very heavily. Somewhere over the region of £30 million has been spent in the last 2 years on strike pay. So the RMT knew that battle was coming. It knew its members were somewhat reticent to go on, extended strike actions. And it had the resources because, as I said earlier, it has £25 million worth of stocks and shares. It could have, sold those to build up a fund to pay for this. And Mick Lynch often said that the strikes were the battle of their lives. They were, sufficiently important. It was kind of make or break for the union. So that's the kind of issue that I think that he's fallen down on. And I think that helps explain why the two settlements that I referred to earlier for Network Rail and the train operating companies have not been the outcomes that the RMT itself wanted or anyone else in the union wanted. They weren't defeats, but they certainly weren't victories either. So I think that's an issue of strategic planning, which is very important. And in my view, Mick Lynch falls down on that. In terms of his wider leadership style, he, from the testimonies that I took from those who have worked with him or have knowledge of him as RMT members, he does have a tendency to be somewhat authoritarian and domineering. So you would contrast that in terms of analysis of leadership styles as being rather less participative, rather less maybe democratic than some other leadership styles. Now, that's not particularly a great revelation, because many union leaders have run their unions, even though they are formally democratic organisations, they have run their unions with rods of iron. And there are certain characterizations of unions which are more or less democratic depending on the leadership style. So it's not unusual for that to happen in a union. What is probably unusual is that you've got somebody who many people know and probably would somehow infer that he wasn't quite like that from what they see of him on television or on the radio, because he presents a kind of manner that isn't necessarily compatible with that. So to that extent, there is a Mick Lynch the public see, and then there's another kind of Mick Lynch which the activists and other officers of the union would see. And what he's done in terms of that leadership style is that once his opponents were defeated in the union over the conception of how the union should run, Mick Lynch's conception is that the union essentially should be run by its full-time officers. So those officers are elected by the members, but once the members elect the officers are there to run the union. That's his conception of the union. The faction that he defeated had another conception of the union, which was that the national executive members, who are all working railway workers, but are essentially seconded for 3 years at a time to do the national executive union jobs, they should be running the union. So there was a big battle over that, which is why Mick Lynch's predecessor, Mick Cash, left the union as general secretary. So he, if you like, Mick Lynch became king of the castle after defeating those opponents. And certainly from what I was able to get from testimony within the union, that situation has more or less continued. That's not to say that Mick Lynch always gets his way. There were instances where Mick Lynch was overruled by his national executive. In early January 2023, Mick Lynch said there would be no more strikes. That clearly wasn't the case, because there were strikes on both disputes after that point. So he was overruled by his executive. And at one point, Mick Lynch also engaged in what I call in the book a form of sharp power, which is there's things like soft power, hard power, sharp power. Sharp power is, if you like, being rather economical with the truth, engaging in forms of manipulation. There was an instance where Mick Lynch said that the train operating companies imposed a no-strike agreement, or put forward a no-strike agreement, rather, in the draft agreement that they wanted the RMT to sign in order to end that particular dispute. Now, Mick Lynch, as I say, he argued that the employers had imposed that. The evidence is contrary to that. That essentially, that no-strike agreement was in there from the first draft. It was in the second draft. It was not somehow by magic or whatever process imposed in the third draft. So that reflects the fact that I think there was a revolt against that, essentially that no-strike agreement being in the agreement by the national executive. So another example of where he was overturned, but also had to engage in rather sharp practices to get himself out of that hole. So that gives you some indication of he's a canny operator. He's a a well-versed operator, and he's usually a successful operator. And the final thing I could say about his leadership style is that compared to his predecessor like Bob Crowe, Mick Lynch is much more a negotiator as a union leader than he is a mobiliser. That's not to say that he's not capable of going out and geeing up the members and all that sort of thing, but in his own words, he sees his greatest skills lying in being able to negotiate a deal. That is to say, he sees negotiation as a more of an art than a skill almost. He elevates it to that level, and he believes that he has the skills developed over time to basically negotiate deals. And to some extent, he's been proven right in that, because the deals that were done were accepted ultimately by the members, even though I don't think they did so with much enthusiasm.
One final question I have, which you sort of alluded to at the beginning of the interview. So I used to be in academia, and I've studied a lot about the history of socialism, Marxism, you know, critical theory. But I feel that when in academia, people are in their own ivory tower, the things they read, the things they talk about, there's no way you can convey that to the ordinary working class people. And at the beginning, when you were talking about the idea of a working class hero, and you said that many people might have forgotten about that concept simply because, well, unions have been unfortunately undermined and disempowered. What lessons do you think Mick Lynch, his style of leadership, his ability to either negotiate or, more importantly, to mobilize people, what lessons do you think it might have for the current left, either in England or Australia or America or anywhere, in terms of, you know, being able? Because I've talked to a lot of people, and they say that the left needs to go back to being able to mobilize and socialize more with the working class people. So what lessons do you think the phenomena of Mick Lynch has for the left today?
I think the overriding lesson that we can, or conclusion that we can take away from, you know, studying Mick Lynch is that at the moment we do need leaders like Mick Lynch in terms of people who are capable of having a coherent progressive left-wing ideology that cuts against the, you know, the dominant neoliberal ideology that kind of rules the world. So we need that, but there are many people that can offer that. We need people who are very well versed in terms of being able to put an argument under pressure, particularly, you know, in when they're under the public gaze or the media gaze. It's not just the argument, or it's not just the argument that is to be made. It's who also is able to make that argument. Now, again, there are many people on the left who have that skill, in colloquial terms, the gift of the gab. They can, through force of personality, they can come across as being very convincing, almost inspiring. But what most of those people that have the arguments and the ability to put the argument, what they don't have is the opportunity to really have a mass audience for what they're saying and what they're doing. And Mick Lynch clearly did at that time. Now, this is where the kind of tension, if you like, between individuals as active agents and the kind of environment they operate in has to be borne in mind. You have a kind of dynamic tension between the two. And Mick Lynch, because of things I've explained, he ended up being General Secretary of the RMT Union at a particular point of time. He then was availed of the opportunity to make the argument in a way that came across as convincing. So he was making the argument at a time that the RMT was fighting back by striking. He was also making the argument at the time when the cost of living crisis was happening. And because of the absence of radical voices, you know, the Labour Party wasn't doing this. And that's why people said at the time that they wished that Mick Lynch was leader of the Labour Party and not Keir Starmer. He was able to do all those things. Now, 2 years on from, or getting on towards 2 years on from summer of 2022, now that we're in 2024, it's a more difficult situation. Certainly in Britain, we're in the run-up to an election, and therefore there are certain pressures on people to, if you like, not rock the boat, don't do anything that will jeopardise Labour's chances of winning. But the cost of living crisis seems to be easing somewhat. It doesn't mean there's not still massive social inequality. There is, but that spur to action that happened in the summer of 2022 does seem to be easing a little, certainly in terms of the number of strikes that are going on in Britain. So if you're to say, what are the lessons of 2022 or Mick Lynch when he was at his height of notoriety in 2022? As, if you like, social scientists, we have to be aware that we cannot transpose something, you know, the lessons of something from 2022, even only 2 years later in 2024. We must take cognizance of the changes while at the same time trying to, if you like, see the more fundamental, more perennial lessons that can be learned. So what I would say is, if we want a kind of single takeaway from Mick Lynch, is that the left can provide leadership to mass struggles and be part of mass struggles at certain points in time, but it has to be, if you like, credible at the point when those mass struggles erupt. The left cannot just suddenly present itself as saying, well, we've always said this and we've got the best solutions and so on, and therefore you should just believe us. It cannot do that. It must build up the credibility and implant itself with roots over the years that people know who the left are at the point when there is a crisis, and they present a different solution to the crisis compared to the, you know, the austerity that the neoliberals have imposed on us. So I think that's the kind of single biggest takeaway. It takes a lot of work over many, many years. You must be able to take advantage of the opportunity when it presents itself. Now, the one, I suppose, the other issue that Mick Lynch has faced, I've alluded to it before, but in a more specific terms, in August 2022, an organisation called Enough is Enough was set up, and it was the RMT, the Communication Workers Union, the CWU Union, and some others. They tried to set up kind of left-wing campaigning pressure group, which was a great step forward at the time. But within a matter of months, that organisation, which had between 750,000 and 1 million people sign up to it in terms of, you know, giving their details to it. It wasn't a membership organisation, but it was like you could support it. Within a matter of months, that organisation started to become almost defunct because, unfortunately, it was too tied up to the ongoing course of the disputes of those two unions, the RMT and the CWU. But it did show the potential there. So the other more minor lesson I think I would suggest from the what's happened over the last couple of years is that we do need a new political form of organisation. We do need a new, maybe not a political party, but we do need something new that is of a mass scale, that is credible, that is campaigning on the kind of basic material grievances that people have. Because certainly the Labour Party isn't doing it. And therefore, there is, to use the term, a gap in the market. Whether that can be filled so easily now as it might have done in 2022, you know, is a question which we can pick over. But I think some of the fertile ground that existed in 2022 is not quite so good as it is now in 2024.
Professor Gregor Gehl, thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk to us about your wonderful book. The book is called Mick Lynch, Making of a Working Class Hero, published in January 2024 by Manchester University Press. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.